This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Super Tuesday narrowed the spotlight in the Democratic presidential primary. Yesterday's results forecast a race between two men, former Vice President Joe Biden and Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. The majority of North Carolina Democrats cast their votes for Biden, giving him the state and adding fuel to his comeback after a landslide win in the South Carolina primary. And today, former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg announced that he is suspending his campaign and endorsing Joe Biden. So moving down the ballot here in North Carolina, most races went as expected, except for the Republican primary for lieutenant governor. First-time candidate Mark Robinson beat eight other candidates, including superintendent of public instruction and a former congresswoman. Also, two incumbent state legislators lost their primary elections. So we're going to go through Super Tuesday results in North Carolina with WUNC Capitol Bureau Chief Jeff DeBeery and WUNC politics reporter Rusty Jacobs. Jeff, Rusty, good to have you here.
Hey there, Frank.
Rusty, let me start with you in this lieutenant governor's race now. Mark Robinson, who is he? And tell us about this race.
There's a good reason why you're asking. He's a political neophyte. He's from Greensboro. And really what had made him famous and put him on the map was a viral video of him making an impassioned, fiery, even speech lambasting the Greensboro City Council over cancellation of a gun show at the Greensboro Coliseum. Now, this was in April of 2018. It was not long after the Parkland shooting, but he took the Greensboro City Council to task over that. He's become a darling of the NRA. And as you pointed out, he beat out a crowded field that included an experienced state senator, Mark Johnson, the outgoing DPI superintendent, and he got the requisite 30% plus to take that nomination outright.
That he came from nowhere is a surprise, and that he got that 30% in a field of nine candidates. But tell us a little more, because he didn't spend much money either, right?
Right. Caught him at a meet and greet event down in the Cumberland County. The Republican Party was holding a meeting. He was one of the candidates. Shut up. It should be pointed out, too, he would be the first African-American lieutenant governor in North Carolina. This is the power of the internet. This is the power of social media. His video was seen by more than a million. If his website, campaign website, is to be believed, it was viewed a lot of times. And he is riding support from a really conservative niche in the Republican community. These are NRA gun supporting. He's seen as a Second Amendment rights champion. And, you know, the lieutenant governor is that position is generally seen as maybe a springboard to governor. There's not a lot you can accomplish other than maybe breaking a tie vote in the Senate as the president of the Senate. Nonetheless, he got the attention he needs.
It's statewide office. It is a statewide office. And as you say, it doesn't have much power in and of itself, but you're running all across the state and getting that attention. Well, Jeff, let's talk about the Democratic primary for lieutenant governor.
Sure. This was a little bit of a surprise to us. This was a race really between three state lawmakers, Yvonne Holley, who is a Wake County Democrat in the House, Chaz Beasley, who is a Mecklenburg County Democrat in the North Carolina House, and Terry Van Dine, who is a state senator from Buncombe County. And Van Dine posted some really impressive fundraising numbers in the lead up to the Super Tuesday primary. We're talking north of $400,000. And the conventional wisdom was that Holley and Beasley, both of whom are African-American, may split the black vote, and that Van Dine, with this war chest, had a chance to get greater than that 30% plus one threshold that Rusty just mentioned and avoid a runoff. Well, conventional wisdom is a dangerous thing at many points, and this would be one of those examples. So last night, Holley carried about 26.5% of the vote. Van Dine checking in a little bit more than 20%. She has to request the runoff. That formality hasn't happened yet. I would be very surprised if she doesn't, but we are headed toward a runoff in that lieutenant governor primary on the Democratic side.
And if it does end up being Holley Robinson, we're talking about the first African-American lieutenant governor in North Carolina.
Just no matter what, we'll know come May 13th, right? Potentially.
Yeah. May 13th, that would be the runoff. Let's talk about the governor's race. Rusty, how did the Republican primary shake out there? No surprise.
Correct. Lieutenant governor Dan Forrest, two-term lieutenant governor, and has done what he was expected to do. I mean, he was seen as somebody who really aspired to being governor one day. So he won his primary against State Representative Holly Grange, a military veteran, won it outright with a fairly by a wide margin, close to 90% of the vote. And now he gets to taking on Roy Cooper, and it's going to be a bit battle. I'm sure you'll hear from Jeff. It's going to be an expensive battle. Roy Cooper's got millions on hand, Dan Forrest, from the latest report, the latest campaign finance report that I saw, had just under $1 million on hand, but a lot of money is going to be pouring in because a lot of eyes, especially nationwide, are on North Carolina for Senate for the Senate race, and especially and the governor's race as well.
Yeah, talk more about that, Jeff. The incumbent, obviously, Roy Cooper, will be the nominee for the Democrats, but this race is really important, even in the eyes of the National Party.
There are only 11 gubernatorial races in the country this year, and from the conversations I've had with people, the belief is that for Republicans, this is the best opportunity to pick up an executive mansion. This was a race, as a lot of listeners will remember, was decided ultimately by about 10,300 votes 4 years ago. So ultimately, who turns out and how the suburbanites split and what Cooper has done to please some or perhaps tick off others. And the same goes for Forrest, but Cooper has a little bit more of a pedestal, obviously, these past 4 years. That is going to decide this thing. We expect this to be close. We expect there to be tens of millions, if not north of $100 million in spending.
It's so interesting because it's so hard to read anything into Cooper's victory 4 years ago. On the one hand, very narrow margin, so you'd say, well, not a strong candidate. On the other hand, it's a time when the president, top of the ticket, Republican Donald Trump, takes the state of North Carolina. How did the Republican incumbent actually lose that race? So it's hard to know how to read that.
Right. So just to flash back to 4 years ago, I would say short term, McCrory did himself no favors as we think about HB2, the I-77 toll issue in Mecklenburg County, the issue of film credits in New Hanover and Wilmington. And then historically, if we look across the last 13 general elections in North Carolina, on 9 different occasions, going back to 1968, voters have sent a Republican to the White House and a Democrat to the executive mansion. So ticket splitting has a long history here.
All right, let's skip down to the U.S. Senate race. Jeff, I'll stick with you for a second. Another one that's attracted national attention, and as expected, former state lawmaker Cal Cunningham defeated State Senator Erica Smith and 3 other Democrats in that primary. How do you see these results?
He has demonstrated, Cunningham, an ability to raise a lot of money and to do it from a lot of the establishment levers and channels in recent months. He carried this race with precisely 57% of the vote. Obviously, that could tweak a little bit, but he won comfortably. He won by more than 20 percentage points, and he will now take on the Republican incumbent Tillis in what is viewed as one of the very most in-play 50-50 Senate races in the country, along with Colorado, Arizona, and Maine. And the narrative that I've heard from people on both the right and the left is that if Cunningham can knock off Tillis, it may very well be the tipping point for Democrats, meaning they could take back the U.S. Senate.
Oh, yeah. The Republicans talk about how they looked at this primary because Tillis is the incumbent. But for a moment, he was actually facing a challenge just a few months ago.
Well, I mean, you got to remember that Tom Tillis made a very public or visibly calculated decision to get as close to Trump as possible and abandoned a position that threatened to make him an outcast in the party. And that's when he decided that he would support funding for President Trump's border wall. At one time, he had staked out a courageous position, some people would say. So he's flipped, and he has tried very hard to cast himself as a conservative supporter of Trump's policies. And we'll see how that's working. I talked to voters last night at the GOP headquarters in Raleigh, and one gentleman I spoke to acknowledged that Tillis doesn't always make the decisions he would support, but he sees him as a reliable conservative.
All right, Jeff, 2 North Carolina state legislators lost their primary elections last night. Tell us about them.
They did. We had our eyes on one of these seats. That one is in Cumberland County, and Elmer Floyd is a multi-term incumbent. He's a Democrat, and listeners will remember that districts were redrawn last fall after a 3-judge panel struck down North Carolina's legislative districts for being illegally gerrymandered along partisan lines. And they went through the redistricting process, and Elmer Floyd raised some concerns at the legislature. I mean, Rusty covered this, and we both saw this. We both heard from him. It wasn't like a big screaming match, but he alluded to some concerns that he had over these maps moving forward. So he was defeated last night. This was not all that much of a surprise. There was an effort from Republicans to get involved in this race and knock him off. This is a seat that could swing Republican come the general election. And then Senator Gallimore also lost last night. And that was a little bit more of a surprise from my perspective. But when you have 170 races, you can't keep up with all of them.
No, but all of this points to the fact that we are looking at far more competitive races at the legislative level that we've ever seen or certainly seen in the past 10 years, Rusty. This sets up, again, if you're talking about turnout, maybe more interest in this election.
Absolutely. And you know, a lot of people have made moves recently. You've seen a couple of senators, certainly ones that Jeff mentioned, but two more senators on the Democratic side in the state Senate have moved on. Floyd McKissick from Durham, right, went on has been appointed to the Utilities Commission. And Terry Van Dyne, as we heard, may be asking for a runoff in the lieutenant governor's race on the Democratic side. There will be two new people who were probably the presumptive winners of the seats because those are heavily Democratic areas.
All right, let's talk about the very briefly top of the ticket Democratic voters in North Carolina. Jeff supported Vice President Joe Biden in very large numbers. Any surprises here?
Surprised to the extent that this looked to be a three-horse race within the last 7 to 10 days between Sanders, Bloomberg, and Biden, and then the folks who dropped out and perhaps a lot of or some of Bloomberg support broke for Biden. I mean, it was a huge night for Joe Biden.
Rusty, what are Republicans saying about North Carolina and the Democratic presidential primary?
It's interesting listening to the announcement, some of the speeches, and some of the comments. You could almost sense that they would have liked to be running against or see Bernie Sanders win and prevail in North Carolina because they're casting this as very much an us versus them fight. It is conservatives against radicals. I heard that word come out of at least one person's mouth, that even Joe Biden is being seen as someone who doesn't back the tax cuts that President Trump has put in place along with the Republican Congress. So they're casting it in very stark terms.
All right. We'll talk more about that all day long. Rusty Jacobs is WNC politics reporter. Jeff Tabiri, WNC Capitol Bureau Chief. We've got more with some political analysts on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio. Last night's results in the Democratic presidential primary cast the race as a two-way contest between Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders and former Vice President Joe Biden. Biden built on his momentum after a big win in South Carolina last week, claiming victory in 9 states, including North Carolina and all the southern states, up for grabs. And today, former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg announced that he is suspending his campaign and endorsing Biden. It is right now just about 20 minutes after 12, and so far Elizabeth Warren says she is reconsidering her campaign, but no announcement yet as of 12:20 p.m. Meanwhile, Bernie Sanders, as we say, took Utah, Colorado, Vermont, and California, and as of noon, Maine is too close to call, but Biden is leading there by a small margin. So we've passed a big milestone in this election season. Super Tuesday is behind us. North Carolina's primary election results are drawing battle lines as the general election in November inches closer. We've got lots of smart people here to talk with us about those results. Among them, Deandra Rose, a professor of public policy and political science and director of research for POLIS, the Center for Politics at the Sanford School of Public Policy at Duke University. Welcome back. Good to have
Thank you,
Deandra.
Thank you so much, Frank.
Mike Bitzer is here. Michael Bitzer is a professor of politics and history at Catawba College. Hello, Michael.
Hello.
And Susan Roberts, a professor of political science at Davidson College. Susan Roberts, welcome.
Thank you so much.
Michael, let's start with you and take a look at the turnout and tell us what those numbers tell us so far.
Yeah, so the big question was always about, could this particular race energize and mobilize Democrats more so than 4 years ago when it was Hillary Clinton versus Bernie Sanders? And in North Carolina, we did see a spike up of about 180,000 more Democratic primary ballots that came in yesterday than did 4 years ago. But it was less than 2008 between Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton. That was about 1.5 million yesterday. We're looking at about 1.3. 4 years ago was 1.1 million. So we certainly had more ballots, but actually a lower voter turnout just simply because the population of registered voters has increased so much here in North Carolina.
Susan, what do these turnout numbers tell you about enthusiasm among North Carolina voters? Is it ambiguous or can you tell anything from what we've got?
Well, I think it's less ambiguous than it might seem when we look at some of the younger voters. I think they turned out, but also to think about North Carolina and the race that's ethnically diverse? I mean, because the Pew Research Center says this is the most ethnically diverse race that we had. And I haven't seen the figures break down, but we know that the African Americans turned out. I don't know whether or not we have made primary voting as much of a priority for younger voters, say college-age voters, as we have the general election voters. And so that's something I'd like to see and get a little more information on, because those are the voters that may turn out. And I don't know whether or not you look at the early votings, and Michael's looked at some of the early voting figures, and I think that younger voters were more inclined to vote later and on same day.
All right. Yeah. Well, what about that, Michael? Do we know anything about that and about sort of who turned out?
Well, we do know that about 40% of all the ballots cast in yesterday's election came early. Now, that was actually higher than what we saw 4 years ago when only a third came in early. So I think what we're seeing is typically in the research that I've done on early voting, typically younger voters tend to wait until election day to make their decisions and to show up to cast early ballots. If you look at the exit polls, we've only got about 14% of the electorate was between 18 and 30 years old. So that's about the norm of what we've been seeing around the country in these contests.
Deandra Rose, what do you think? Is there any way that you can tell if we will have more voters or anything about this primary that suggests to you more or less voters in November?
You know, I think that's a central question moving forward. I think for candidates like Bernie Sanders, who are really pushing the idea of having a movement, part of his argument for his candidacy was this idea that he would expand the constituency for the Democratic Party, that he would do a successful job more than any other candidate in bringing in voters who actually sat it out in 2016. Of course, in the aftermath of these results in terms of turnout and early votes, it seems that Senator Sanders actually stayed pretty consistent with his previous performance when it came to the numbers of voters and the proportions that he was able to attract.
Well, in terms of especially young voters who he said he was going to bring in, who had kind of sat it out. And of course, Joe Biden has demonstrated great strength in African-American communities in the places where he's been tested.
Exactly right. So I think that South Carolina, you know, I'm describing it as the gift that keeps on giving for Joe Biden. It's one of those cases where, you know, I think if many of us had been having this conversation a week ago, we would not have presumed that Joe Biden would be the presumptive nominee or the front runner at this point. And that endorsement by Representative Jim Clyburn and his success among African Americans there, I think, really did help to pave the way for his strong performance, especially through Southern states on Super Tuesday.
Susan, what do you make of so Bloomberg drops out. Were you expecting that to happen this quickly? And then his sudden quick endorsement of Joe Biden?
Well, I think that I thought he would wait another day or so. But as he said in his speech, he said he looked at the numbers. And people had said that Bloomberg didn't jump in at first because he had looked at the numbers and he didn't think that he had a chance. And then when he looked and he said he didn't think that himself, he didn't think that Biden was going to be the nominee. I think he discounted Bernie Sanders. So I think that he did jump out. But one thing, it's not this is going to be how the message comes out. This is how Sanders is going to spin it. He didn't want Bloomberg's money. Bloomberg's money probably going to Biden is just increases the narrative between the establishment and the movement that he wants. And so I think that's another theme. I had already, you know, I had really in my mind written a script for Biden to bow out, saying something about how difficult it was to his family and so he could exit gracefully. And we were all surprised. I think South Carolina is the gateway to the South.
What about that, Michael? The idea that Biden is now the front runner. It's now a two-person race, a two-man race, which I think a lot of people 6 months ago would never have predicted that we'd be down to two men at this point. What does all this say to you, especially with Bloomberg bowing out now? And as I say, it's 12:30, Eastern time now. We don't know about Elizabeth Warren quite yet. At the moment, she's still in.
Right. And I think this is where the Democratic Party really is in terms of the coalition that is the modern Democratic Party. There is a significant chunk of voters and elected officials that are kind of center left. But then you have a very aggressive, very active progressive wing, the left in the party. And I think we're seeing this play out dynamically in this race. The thing that surprised me in North Carolina was among the early votes, Bernie Sanders got 24% of the vote. On election day, 24% of the vote. In total, 24% of the vote. So, you know, it's consistent. But, you know, for all the talk, as DeAndre has mentioned, of expanding the electorate, bringing new voters in, bringing new energy into the Democratic Party, yes, his supporters are very active. And they are probably looking at yesterday's results and saying, this is not good for us. Look at what the establishment is doing. But it's the voters who are making the decision in all of these state contests.
And if I might add, younger voters are the least reliable cohort to turn out, and African Americans are much more likely to vote than the younger voters. And so to pin your hopes on just the younger voters to have that energy to turn out on Election Day, that's just not quite enough unless you can get some other support. And as Michael and I were talking earlier, Sanders is doing well with the Hispanic Latina vote.
Well, as I think what Sanders was hoping for was to turn that narrative around, that the reason younger voters aren't turning out is because they never see anybody who sounds exciting enough or different enough for them to show up. And Sanders, I think, was hoping, I'm that guy. I'm going to turn things around. And that's going to change the equation for the Democratic Party and ultimately for in American politics. It appears at this moment his bet was wrong.
Mm-hmm. I think you're right. I mean, on that, Senator Sanders was here in North Carolina about a week ago in Goldsboro, and he was at Greenleaf Baptist Church talking with Reverend Barber, and just very unabashed in his commitment to sweeping change and overall systemic change, talking about revolution. And so I think for many people looking at the results of Super Tuesday and the overall Democratic primary, there's a big question about the identity of the Democratic Party and what it means to be a Democrat at this point.
So it leaves us with the question, what happens with either of these candidates? Let's talk about if Joe Biden is the candidate, what happens to those Bernie supporters, especially the most ardent supporters? Do they sit it out? Are some of them so ardent that they vote for Donald Trump? And on the other hand, you know, the Biden supporters, if they see that Bernie Sanders is at the top of the ticket, are they so moderate and perhaps conservative that some might actually not more than sit it up, but actually support Donald Trump? I mean, let's take each scenario and talk about what happens at the polls with each of these candidates. Among the core supporters of the other candidate. DeAndre, I'll stick with you.
Yeah, I mean, I imagine that we could absolutely see segments of the electorate that feel that the selected candidate does not reflect them sitting it out if they're not inspired enough. So I think that's why it's incumbent on the Democratic Party and whoever gains the nomination to pick a vice presidential person to share the ticket who signals like an olive branch to that other constituency or that other segment of the electorate.
Michael?
Yeah, I would completely agree with that and would note that in most of the exit polls, what we're seeing is anywhere from 60% plus of Democrats saying we have one objective, and that is to beat Donald Trump. And usually the folks that are responding, we want somebody ideologically aligned with us, is only a third. Mm. Now, that creates a real issue with party unity moving forward in the general election. But I think at some point, Barack Obama may come in and say, for the good of the country, for the good of the party, everybody needs to come together.
Susan, what do you think?
Sure. And I think that for Sanders to get the nomination, that would help the more traditional GOP voters to vote with Trump because they could have that same sentiment. Sanders is way too radical, so I can't vote. I have to vote for Trump. And that's the same scenario that happened in 2016. So I think that looking at the narrative, one of the things that the Sanders youth and the voters cannot use this time is that the convention, going into the convention, is quote-unquote rigged because they changed the allocation of superdelegates. And that was perhaps one of the reasons, not the whole reason, but one of the reasons that Sanders supporters just sat it out. They were just not convinced of Hillary Clinton's inevitability, and they didn't like the way the system, and that could be read the establishment, was working.
I'm talking to Deandra Rose, Susan Roberts, and Michael Bitzer, political analysts from around the state. And now let's go out to eastern North Carolina to learn about some of the results in races there. Vince Winkle is on the line. He's a reporter for WHQR in Wilmington. Welcome back, Vince.
Good to be here, Frank.
Let's talk about some of the big races in the eastern part of the state. New Hanover County Board of Commissioners. It's interesting, this race, because of the issues involved and how they bear on, you know, life in eastern North Carolina. But tell us about what happened last night with the Board of Commissioners races.
Yeah, there were three winners from the Republican side and three from the Democratic side that will go on to the November election. You know, a couple of the big issues here right now is New Hanover Regional Medical Center, which is a large and very successful county-owned hospital. The county commissioners have been exploring whether they will sell the hospital to another healthcare system, perhaps merge. And Democrats ran largely opposed to any sort of sale of the medical center, which serves seven or eight counties usually. The Republicans seem to be more in favor of selling the medical center. So that's going to be a big issue heading into November. And they are supposed to vote sometime between now and the election on whether to move forward with a sale or a merger. But people are telling me now that they will probably kick that ball past the November election and let the new commissioners in place deal with it. What's also interesting in New Hanover County is actually, despite the fact that it's grown so much since 2016, we had a few thousand less ballots cast this time around, which I thought was interesting because we've had such an influx of folks moving to the region. The other big issue for the commissioners is we have a public transportation system here called Wave Transit, which has hit some financial struggles. And the county commissioners have been pushing to just completely divest from this public transportation system and let the city deal with it. And again, on that note, Democrats are in favor of keeping the transit system, whereas Republicans were the ones that initially proposed dropping it.
Were they big issues within the party for the primaries? Was there much division among the primary candidates, or were the Democrats and Republicans pretty much aligned on those issues?
Oh, they were very much aligned. And what's interesting is we have five county commissioners currently, three Democrats and two Republicans. However, the chair of the commissioners, a Democrat named Julia Olson Bozeman, always votes with the two Republicans, which has caused some very volatile county commissioner meetings in recent months. So the whole dynamic of that, which will have a huge impact on infrastructure and economic development in this region, those are decisions that rest with the county commissioners, and how this vote goes in November will have quite an impact on how fast development continues to move in this part of the state.
Well, Vince, a couple of county board of education primary races last night, which have been at the center of attention in this community. Tell us about those races.
Yeah, the New Hanover County Board of Education has really come under fire because of several cases of sexual assault involving teachers. In fact, just this week, a middle school teacher was indicted on 17 more counts of first-degree sexual offense, and the board has really taken that on the chin. Three current board members are not seeking re-election, three Republicans, including the board chair, Lisa Estep. And this has been a huge and a passionate issue. Parents are not happy at all, as you can imagine. Three former teachers in the New Hanover County public school system are now behind bars. So that is what both three Republicans that are moving on to the November race all ran on, really changing the tone and improving communication and finding a way to prevent these scandals from ever happening again.
And also a primary race for North Carolina Congressional District 7, and that would be to see who gets to face off against Republican incumbent David Rauser. Tell us about that one.
Yeah, and of course, the kind of the running joke that I heard last night at both GOP and at the Democratic watch parties was, you know, who is going to be the sacrificial lamb that goes up against Rauser? Because he is his district is still heavily Republican. But it was not a close race. And, you know, I'm embarrassed to say that at this moment I just drew
blank. I'm going to give you a second today. We'll figure that out in half a second. But while you're doing that, I want to ask Michael Bitzer a question about regional across the state. And we asked about turnout generally. Was there anything you could tell regionally and anything that piqued your interest about voting patterns in particular parts of the state, Michael?
Yeah, so the Democrat on the District 7 race, Christopher Ward, was the winner of that race. What I was interested in was the turnout in major urban counties compared to particularly rural counties. And in the preliminary numbers that I've seen and been able to kind of crunch so far, it looks like turnout was significantly up in these major urban counties. So Wake County, Mecklenburg County, Guilford, Buncombe. But then when you get out into rural counties, particularly on the Democratic side, the numbers just fell off. So I think what we're seeing is a continuing part of the narrative of North Carolina politics, urban counties moving more Democratic, rural counties moving more Republican. And that's kind of shown in the numbers of who's taking ballots for which political party.
This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. North Carolina voters made their Super Tuesday debut last night. They chose former Vice President Joe Biden for the Democratic nomination. Many races down the ballot in the state went as expected. There were a few exceptions. Political newcomer Mark Robinson defeated eight other candidates in the Republican primary for lieutenant governor. Pundits had expected a runoff in that election, and very few people expected Mark Robinson to be on top. So that was one surprise. Also, two sitting state legislators lost their primary elections, Republican State Senator Eddie Gallimore and Democratic State Representative Elmer Floyd. Former state lawmaker Cal Cunningham defeated State Senator Erica Smith and three other candidates in the Democratic primary for U.S. Senate. So Cunningham will face Republican incumbent Tom Tillis in November. And there will likely be a runoff in the Republican primary for North Carolina's 11th congressional district. And that is the seat vacated by Republican Mark Meadows in western North Carolina. So what do these results tell us about North Carolina voters? Talking to three political experts, Susan Roberts, a professor of political science at Davidson College, Deandra Rose, a professor of public policy and political science at Duke University, and Michael Bitzer, a professor of politics and history at Catawba College. Deandra, let's start with this U.S. Senate race here in North Carolina. What do you make of the fact that Cal Cunningham won, and how do you see the race going forward?
So I think the Democratic primary was fascinating, because Cal Cunningham went up against Erica Smith, and she received some support, and some might characterize it as unwanted support, from a Republican super PAC. And so her support, you know, and I think that was intended to force Cunningham to spend a bit more of his own money, you know, in that race, as opposed to taking it and holding on to it until he gets to go toe-to-toe with Senator Tillis. I think this is shaping up to be one of the most expensive Senate races that we've seen, and also one that generates a lot of attention both inside the state and without.
Yeah, and again, Susan, how do you see this race shaping up in November as it gets closer?
Well, I think I see a continuation of the attraction of outside money to both Cal Cunningham and to his opponent, Tom Tillis. And I think that the Tillis-Hagan race, I believe, at the time was the most expensive race in the country. And I can't see that this might not be the same suggestion of the most expensive race, especially since this is looked on as a battleground state, perhaps not a swing state. What is interesting to me is how Cal Cunningham was able to overcome the ads that were for Erica Smith but not of Erica Smith. And that's kind of interesting because sometimes people make an assessment after the first ad they see and they don't care to watch anymore. So I think that was impressive. But I think the money, and I will go out on a limb and say this will be the most expensive race in the country.
Well, tell us more about those ads and, again, what this tells you. What did you see in his ability, his resilience? What was happening in the ads and what is that? How does the resilience manifest itself?
Well, as I recall, he had to recount some of the accusations made against him. And sometimes that doesn't work very well because then you hear it and you're almost like re-advertising the money that was spent for Smith but against Cunningham. And so I think that that's one of the reasons. And he was able to spend, he did have and get the money to spend. But I think that, again, as Deonda said, it really did. The $15 million really forced, as primaries often do, the money that would otherwise have been spent in the general election. I think he'll make up and have plenty of money going into the general election.
Well, there's going
to
be lots of money coming in from the outside, so that gap will be filled pretty quickly. Michael Bitzer, let's talk about the Senate seat. It's been one that's been very hard for anybody sitting in it to take back, to win re-election, and Tom Tillis is not in a very powerful, strong position right now.
Right. I mean, from what I've seen in terms of polling, he's basically at a third approval, a third disapproval, and a third undecided. And when you're talking about a few months to go into the general campaign, we could basically say the general campaign starts today. That's not a good area to be in. Now, the likelihood is that both parties will see their supporters come home. Self-identified Democrats will be naturally supporting Cal Cunningham, Republicans supporting Tom Tillis. But as Susan mentioned, in this state that is such a battleground and so narrowly tailored to both sides, we're talking about races where less than 5% difference between the winner and the loser is going to make a major impact, not just here in North Carolina, but potentially on the national dialogue with control of the Senate being up for grabs.
Susan, we've also been talking about national attention in the gubernatorial race, and I know you've been watching. What are you going to be watching for between the Republican Lieutenant Governor Dan Forrest and Democratic incumbent Roy Cooper?
Well, the one thing that I thought was a little bit amusing, I've seen several articles that said North Carolina was a moderate state. And I think I don't see that in terms of the ideology. And I think they were saying that's why, Cooper's doing so well. North Carolina's moderate. He's a moderate. But I think, again, as we've, mentioned in passing, the top of the ticket is going to have a big impact on Cooper. And myself, I don't know a lot about Dan Forrest, but I know that he has the theme that, Bennett did in the 11th district, and that is pro-God, pro-life, and really some things, and pro-Trump. And so I think that he's going to be all those things, if not more. One thing about Tom Tillis is that he got a little chastised by Donald Trump, especially after, as we've mentioned, writing that column that he supported the wall but didn't like the use of the emergency powers. And Trump kind of sort of forgave him, but it wasn't one of these things, a full-throated endorsement of Tom Tillis. That will come, I'm sure, because Tom Tillis will toe the line.
Yeah.
To interrupt that, the Republican National Convention being there, that will help Tillis a great deal.
All right. Deonda, talk more about this, because we talk generally about the impact of the top of the ticket on this race nationally. What do Bernie supporters do if Biden's the candidate, vice versa? Mm-hmm. But let's talk about North Carolina and the down ballot choices. If you weigh either of those two candidates, what's the effect of those two candidates on the down ballot?
Absolutely. I think that it matters a great deal to the state of North Carolina and our down ballot races who's at the top of the ticket. So if there's a candidate like Bernie Sanders, it really could push a number of more moderate voters and more moderate Democrats and people who identify as independents to cast their votes down the Republican side of the ticket. And that really could be problematic for Governor Cooper.
That is, let's go around the table on that because, this is a state that where voters often split tickets and where everybody's very close to the line, Michael Bitzer. answer. Would you say that that's the case, that the closer to the middle you are at the top of the ticket, at least in the state of North Carolina, the better it might be for Democrats?
It certainly helps. I mean, I describe North Carolina as a center-lean right state, and certainly Republicans have a built-in advantage. But I think what we could potentially see this fall is a generational divide really occurring. Looking at the voter registration pool, 36% of North Carolina's registered voters are under the age of 40. That's millennials, that's Gen Zs, and that's a plurality of the voters. Now, if those folks show up, it could be a whole new dynamic that we haven't expected here in North Carolina. But you're right. I mean, it's rare to see a lot of folks nowadays kind of split their tickets, but there's enough voters out in North Carolina that can do that, that can really shift the dynamics in very close competitive elections.
Susan?
Well, I think also when we look at some of the electorate in North Carolina, half of the electorate wasn't born in North mm-hmm. Carolina, and how much of an impact will that have? And also the fact that unaffiliated voters inch out, I think, the Democrats and Republicans in terms of identity. I may be wrong there, but I think that that's kind of a wild card. And when you have someone that's popular, I never have figured out the McCrory-Cooper effect. And I think, you know, that throws a little bit of a wild card in there about what you can expect from down ballot in terms of North Carolinians. But I think, and I always have, that the RNC, should they, I think the RNC and the DNC are both, what they say, in conversation about holding the national conventions. I think that's going to help Republicans all the way down the line, because it gives them name recognition that some people, especially younger voters, just might not have down ballot.
Talking to Susan Roberts, Deandra Rose, and Michael Bitzer, political analyst from around the state. Matt Bush joins us now. He's taken us to Western North Carolina to look at the results there. He's news director at Blue Ridge Public Radio in Asheville. Welcome back, Matt.
Good afternoon, Frank.
Let's talk about this open congressional seat in your part of the state. Republican Congressman Mark Meadows announced he's not seeking re-election. That opened up the seat. Talk about the Democratic and Republican primaries.
So the Democratic primary went kind of as expected. Mo Davis is a former Guantanamo Bay prosecutor who had returned to North Carolina a few years ago. He won the Democratic primary pretty easily, got 47% in a five-candidate field. On the Republican side, there were 11 candidates, and going into the evening, it seemed unlikely that anybody might hit the 30% threshold needed to avoid a runoff, and that is exactly what happened.
And there's a lot of drama then around that Republican primary, but maybe not much so much in the general election. A pretty solidly Republican district, even after the court-ordered redistricting. Am I right?
It is, yes. Our political analyst out here, Chris Cooper, said it went from Meadows' retirement and the redrawing of the districts made it a solid Republican district to a leans Republican district. But who the candidate Republicans are going to put up, that's still yet to be determined, as we're going to go to a runoff here in a few weeks between Meadows' chosen successor and kind of a surprise candidate who finished a surprise second place last night.
Speaking of runoffs, Buncombe County State Senator Terry Van Dyne could be in a runoff election, Democratic primary for lieutenant governor, right?
Yes, that's the other race that could be going to a runoff. She has yet to decide whether she'll seek it, but she finished in second place to Yvonne Holley in the Democratic primary for lieutenant governor. And you were talking about the Republican primary earlier. Very interesting. There were more candidates in the Republican primary for lieutenant governor that didn't go to a runoff, but the Democratic side is going to go to a runoff, and those will take place, looks like, in May.
Western North Carolina has five open seats for the General Assembly in November. What kind of trends do you see in those primaries, Matt?
Right now, we've seen a lot of familiar faces take these seats. Julie Mayfield is Nashville City Councilwoman. She won the Democratic primary to replace Van Dyne in a seat that's pretty solidly Democratic in the state Senate, in the state House, a Henderson County seat that's currently held by Chuck McGrady, a very well-known and pretty powerful legislator in Raleigh, also known for being very moderate. The Republican primary there yesterday was won by Tim Moffitt, a former Buncombe County state representative. He has moved into this district in Henderson County, so he won there. And to the west, Jim Davis ran for Congress, did not win, didn't finish second, and somewhat of a surprise. So his seat looks like it's going to be filled by Kevin Corbin, who's a current state representative who's moving up, it looks like, if things go as predicted in the fall, to the state Senate. And then there's District 119, which will be for the fifth straight year. Joe Sam Queen, a Democrat, will face Republican Mike Clampett's pretty interesting district. It covers three counties, also includes the campus of Western Carolina University. And these two have gone back and forth. Queen won in 2018, Clampett won in 2016, and this will be round five. And so a lot of familiar faces did well here yesterday, sort of a graduating up almost in some of these positions in Western North Carolina.
All right, Matt, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Matt Bush, news director for Blue Ridge Public Radio. We talked about this Mark Meadows retirement and what's going on in North Carolina's 11th congressional district. Susan, what do you make of that race and that seat? It's been redrawn, as we say, but it looks pretty comfortably Republican, but maybe not. What do you make of it?
Well, I think it's comfortably Republican, but I think I was surprised that Wayne King, who I know was his chief of staff, he finished fourth. But Bennett had so much more money, and so there was a lot of money dumped into that race, and I was surprised that it wasn't a little closer between one, two, and three. But I think that I'd be surprised if that didn't go Republican.
All right. Let's talk about other congressional races, other congressional seats. Michael Bitzer, what are you watching in the state now that we've got redrawn maps? Things more interesting this year?
A little bit. I mean, what I think the expectation with the redrawn maps are going to show is probably an 8-5 Republican over Democratic split there in the 2nd congressional district. Deborah Ross, who ran for the U.S. Senate, easily won with almost 70% of the vote. And then in the Greensboro and Winston-Salem area, congressional district 6, Kathy Manning, who ran in that same area, but it was district 13. Against Republican Ted Budd and lost that race. She won last night with 48% for the Democratic nomination. So those two districts, I think, you know, in Wake County area and then in the Triad area will be Democratic seats.
All right, let's talk about the big wild card in this upcoming race in November, the coronavirus. What impact do you expect that might have, Deandra?
You know, I think it'll really shake things up. And I think especially for candidates who are trying to press the flesh and meet more voters, there may be questions about just how responsible they are holding large public events in the face of this this virus as it continues, as fears around it continue to grow. So we've seen companies like Facebook and Amazon actually cancel large public events in recent days. And so there might be questions about candidates who press on with their campaigns.
Which just means you'll have to use more Facebook and Twitter to run your campaign.
Yeah.
So it probably doesn't hurt them that much. Susan, what do you think?
Well, I think it's going to have an impact. I think Trump's characterization of this as a hoax is going to be out of circulation quite soon because people are taking it personally and not politically. I think that Trump's response, say the national disaster or natural disaster in Puerto Rico, in which he threw paper towels, his fear mongering about immigrants, and what you could call his kind of schizophrenic view of where we are in the world in global politics. That is something that I think Trump will have some baggage when it comes to that. And I think Trump's Teflon has been the economy, and we'll see what happens there. I'm not an economist, and I don't know about recession. I think this may be something that is looming because it all points to our vulnerability, and people don't like to feel vulnerable.
Michael?
I think certainly, you know, if we're talking about this come October, it's going to have a significant impact. I'm not sure that it will last until that point in time. Potentially, it could grow even worse, could slow the economy down, as Susan was saying. But I would be interested, if we are dealing with this in the fall, do we see an uptick in the use of absentee by mail ballots? Typically, about 2-3% of a general election is done by mail. Could people decide, you know what, I'm just not going to chance going to vote early in a crowded field or wait on election day to stand in line. I'll just request an absentee by mail ballot. We could see an uptick in that form of voting.
Michael Bitzer, a professor of politics and history at Catawba College. Susan Roberts, a professor of political science at Davidson College. Deandra Rose, a professor of politics and public policy at Duke. Thank you all for being on the program.
Thanks so much for having
Thank
us
you.
Here.
Thanks.
Find out more and the results at our website, stateofthings.org. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.